when I was in high school, I believe it was. But I remember there was, I used to know music a lot better than I do now. I don't know most of the songs today, and I don't even know, you put something on the radio, and there's very little chance I would even know what the name of the singer is, just because I don't listen to it that much. But when I was in high school, I used to listen to music all the time. And back when I was in high school, there was one song, and the song was, and if you're anywhere over 50, well, really, anybody probably has heard this song, even if you're, you know, no matter what your age, you probably heard this song. And it was very, very famous, very, very popular, and it, quite frankly, it was probably a number one hit from a group that I never cared that much about, but the song was very, very, you know, right at the top of the charts, I guess you could say. And the name of the song was I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And it was by a group called the Rolling Stones, which are still around. In fact, I was watching the Super Bowl, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, and I saw that Mick Jagger doing all these gyrations, and I thought, that guy's older than I am. He's going to hurt the next day, which I do today because we went back to my mother's this week. She's putting in front porch. She's extending her front porch, and they're going to lay concrete. And so we thought, my sister and Pina, I thought we'd go over there and dig up the plants and try to make it easier. Well, some of those bushes, it's amazing how their roots start going down. And I hurt my back a little bit. And really, I've never really had back problems. And but I strained my back a little bit. Man, I feel sorry for people that have back problems because it's got to be tough. But back to the try to get back where I was heading here because I'm way off base. Nothing I've said has anything to do with the sermon except the name of the song. I Can't Get No Satisfaction was the name of the song. And I wrote down the lyrics a while back, and I'm going to read the lyrics. I'm not going to sing it for your sake, but think about these words. It says, I can't, here's the song begins. I can't get no satisfaction because I try and I try and I try and I try and I can't get no, I can't get no. Da, da, da. When I'm driving in my car and a man comes on the radio, he's telling me more and more about some useless information supposed to fire my imagination. I can't get no, oh, no, no, no. These are right off the lyrics here. Hey, 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 that's what I say. I can't get no satisfaction. When I'm watching my TV and a man comes on and tells me how white my shirt should be, well, I can't be a man because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. I can't get no satisfaction. And then it goes on. Now, you listen to this and you think, yeah, there's a lot of useless information in these lyrics. But how often today the music comes on, you're singing to the tune, and you don't even think about what the words are. Then when sometimes you think about the words are, you think, man, is that what I'm singing? But I like the way the song sounded. I didn't really stop to think that much about what the words were. But the song expresses a deep dissatisfaction in life. The entire song is like nothing is going right, is basically what the singers are saying. So on one extreme, you could say you have this totally discontented person where nothing seems to be going the way they want it to go. Then you've got the other side of people that sort of Pollyanna, like, oh, they don't even care what's going on. Everything's just float along. Well, there's basically two views, I guess you could say, in life. One is, you know, to be thankful and contented, but the other is what I'd like to talk about today, and that is just not being happy. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in this world that you'd almost have to not have your mind, your total faculties, without realizing there's a lot of things going on in this world today that are bad, that are frightening, and people just move along. And Penny was mentioning this to me today. She said, you know, I think everybody out there knows something's not right. Things aren't right, but they just don't know what to do about it. And quite frankly, there's not a lot we can do about life except our own life. But people today are very, very discontented. It doesn't matter whether it's there's just a lot of discontent, let's put it that way, in the world today. Now, Solomon, I spoke on Solomon last time I was here, but Solomon exemplified a man that had so much, more than any man I guess you'll ever know of what he had, yet he was not a happy person, especially when he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. He said a lot of things that make you think. But I, like I said, I spoke on Solomon last time I was here, but I want to take a look at 1 Kings chapter 11. The sermon's not on Solomon, but 1 Kings chapter 11. Oh, I know what else I meant to mention. I know, even though Don Sharp is home from the hospital, you know, they're not really that healthy, as you know. And Donna is running herself down, running around trying to, like, when she was at the hospital, she would never go home. I mean, I saw her, she had the same thing on for about 3 or 4 days in a row because she never went home. And I think, you know, after a while she went home and took a shower. But she does a lot for Donnie. And I'm sure that, she, you know, not only Don, prayers for him, but prayers for Donna too, because she's, you know, she's just a wonderful lady, and it's tough to watch your husband or your wife or any relative being sick like that. So that, I did want to mention that. But Solomon, over in 1 Kings chapter 11, it's interesting and sad both at the same time. But let's notice verse 1 through verse 4 of the problem, a huge problem that Solomon had in his life. And we know about how Solomon had wisdom and how God blessed him and gave him so many things. But in verse 1 of chapter 11, 1 Kings, but King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. Now, what was the problem with the foreign women? Because God had told them back in the, you know, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, that if you marry people with, you know, these false religions back in the Canaanites and various ones, they would turn your heart away. And that's what they were telling Solomon. But Solomon didn't listen to what God told him. Solomon, he loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. And you start reading about all, what was their problem? The false religions and all the pagan worship that they were doing. So, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them. They told us Israelites, be careful. Be careful what you're getting yourself into. Nor they with you. Why? Why? Was God just being mean? Of course not. God was trying to help the Israelites. And he said, they will surely turn away your hearts after other gods. And they worshipped all types of odd things. You know, they were even passing their children through the fire. They're sacrificing their children, various and sundry things. But Solomon clung to these women in love. Now, this is, I read this before. This is the strangest verse in the Bible, as far as I'm concerned. And Solomon had 700 wives. Not a real smart thing, Solomon. Not a real smart thing for, can you imagine being one of his wives and you're married? How much attention would you get when he had 699 other wives? I mean, it seems like, doesn't even seem possible, but of course it was. So he had 700 wives, their princesses, 300 concubines. His wives turned away his heart. For it was so, here's the problem, when Solomon was old. Now, I assume he wrote Ecclesiastes toward the end of his life, and hopefully maybe he was obviously telling some lessons of what not to do in Ecclesiastes. But when he was old, so when he was older, it doesn't say at the very end of his life, but it says when he was old, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart away to other gods, just like God said would happen. His wives turned his heart away to other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David, like David's heart. So Solomon just turned away from God. Now, when he wrote Ecclesiastes, I want to read Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 3 and 4. Solomon in Ecclesiastes was trying to tell people what not to do. He had learned a lot of lessons, and we don't know for sure how well he incorporated these lessons either. But verse 3 and 4, Ecclesiastes 9, he says, there's an evil that is done under the sun. There's an evil thing, he was saying, going on. That one thing happens to all. True, the hearts of the son of men, or the sons of men, are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts. Well, it's got to be madness to feel like you need 700 wives and 300 concubines. It's got to be madness to think you need to have two husbands or two wives or three or four. I mean, madness was happening out there. Madness is in their heart. They live, and after that, they all go to the dead. Every human being that's born, physical person, they die. But, of course, God has a future. God has a resurrection. For him who is joined to all the living, or for him who is joined to all the living, as long as you're alive, there's hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. No matter how powerful, no matter the most powerful men, women in the world, we all eventually physically die. So this life, if this life was all there was to it, remember what Paul says? Just, if this was all there was to it, then why would you care? But there's more to it. God created people for a reason, not just to live their life and die and it over with. There's more to it. And anyone that believes in or says they believe in evolution and things like that and say that there's no God, how could you believe that? There's always got to be a beginning. But people try to justify all types of things. We all have lived our life. We've all seen it. And we see it in ourselves from time to time. We all do. See things that we do that we look back and we think, why did I do that? Now, if a person can't get satisfaction they're seeking, what do most people do? When a person is not happy, when a person is not getting satisfaction, what do most people do? And you know the answer, they complain. I mean, how many times in my life have I complained? Well, I wish I could say I could count on one hand. I can't even count. I mean, human beings complain. And we all do it from time to time. But we need to take a look at ourselves and ask ourselves, why do we complain so much? And I'm not talking to anyone in particular. I'm not thinking of anyone in particular. I know some people complain more than others. But humanly speaking, look at us. We tend to complain. We tend to complain about things. And quite frankly, in the world we live, there's a lot to be concerned about. There's a lot of things to be worried about. There's a lot of things that aren't going right. We live in a wonderful country in many ways, but we live in a country that has lost its bearings in many ways too. But I remember working at a grocery store when I lived in Nashville when I was a teenager called H.C. Hill's Grocery Stores. And there was a man that worked there named Mr. Marbury. And I don't know how old he was. He seemed real old to me. Of course, when you're a teenager, 40-year-old seems old. And when you're our age, 40-year-old seems young. So life is all in how you look at it, I guess. But Mr. Marbury seemed real old. But the thing I really remember the most about Mr. Marbury is I've never in my entire life ever met a man that complained as much as Mr. Marbury. He complained constantly. He cussed about everything. He complained. He griped. He moaned. Nothing was ever good. Everything was bad. And one day I came to work. I think it was a Monday. It was after the week because I never worked on the weekends. I remember coming to work on Monday. Mr. Marbury wasn't there. And I asked where he was. And I said, well, he died. And nobody seemed to really care. Nobody seemed to be that concerned that Mr. Marbury just died over the weekend. Well, ask yourself a question. And I've asked myself questions. And it's how many, because I want to take a look at something here. Ask yourself, just, you don't have to ask anybody but you, how many times a day do you complain? Now, I look at myself and I think, oh, some days I don't have a clue how many times I might complain. But there's a book by a man, his name is Hal Urban, and he wrote a book called Life's Greatest Lessons. And in that book, I'm going to quote a few things that he said in that book, but he said in the book, he says, if you're like anything like my students, and he taught both high school and college, he said, if you're like anything or any of the students that I taught in high school or college, you probably complain quite a bit. And he talked about, he said, I'm not criticizing my students. It's just the way things are. And he mentioned for 18 years, he taught high school and college. And every year he conducted an experiment with his students. Every single year, he said, in a class, one day he would say, I want you to do an experiment. I want everyone in here to go home and try to spend 24 hours without complaining one time. And you know what the first response was? They complained. They complained, oh, I can't do this. They were complaining about having to do the assignment. But he said, no, I want you to do this for a reason. I want you to go home and try to go 24 hours without complaining for a reason. And he encouraged him. He says, if you find yourself, if you do it, if you complain, don't stop. Just realize you made a mistake, but take a piece of paper around with you. And every time you catch yourself complaining, write down what you complained about and why for 24 hours. He also asked them if they, to write it down. But he said the next day in class, he would ask them, and he would have about 30 students in a class. He said he would ask them, how many people in this class do you think didn't complain over the last 24 hours? And he said usually they'd say anywhere from 6 to 12. They'd come up with a number. But he said he would always write on a piece of paper a number, and then he would show it up, and he would say, the number is going to be 0, isn't it? And he said for 18 years, he never had a student that said they didn't complain once that past 24 hours. He said not one person. So, it gives me hope because I know I complain sometimes. He said not one person ever said, I didn't complain even once, if they really did the experiment in the right way. Now, Urban said the best part of the experiment came in the discussions afterwards, because he said he would ask them two questions. He asked him, he said, number one, what was the purpose of the assignment? Ask yourself, he said, what was the purpose of this assignment? To try not to complain for 24 hours. And he said, the other thing, he says, what did you learn from trying it? And Urban said, the first question, for what was the purpose of the assignment, most of them would say something like, well, to show us how much we complain, which was the point. But he said, the answer to the second question, what did you learn from trying it, would usually be, we learned that we really don't have really that much to complain about, although we complain. They said, we learned that we really, most of the things we complain about is stupid stuff. And he said that's why he wanted them to take this test, this assignment. Now, he said he also tried the experiment on adults as well as children, and said the only difference between the adults is they seemed to complain even more than the kids did, because they had more time to learn about this, what to complain. In this world, in this country, and I consider myself, I know I'm far, far from the great example here, but ask yourself about this, the thing of complaining. How does that square with God's word, the experiment? There's a scripture I want us to turn to. It's 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6, because this set of scriptures, I think, is something that we can all learn from. I'm not saying, you don't go through life, you're not going to complain about things. And some things are very wrong. It's not wrong to have, I knew somebody once that they complained about people all the time. And they're always talking about what's wrong with this person, what's wrong with that person. And I remember once I asked this person, I said, why are you complaining so much? And they said, we're not complaining. I'm not complaining. I'm evaluating. Well, that could be true or it could be not true. We have to ask ourselves, well, what really are we talking about sometimes? Well, 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. Notice what it says here. Paul speaking to Timothy says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. There's a lot said in that verse. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, what's Paul telling us here? Well, I jotted down the Greek word, and I'm no Greek scholar, but the Greek word for godliness, it's English transliteration of it, is E-U-P-E-P-S-I-A, doesn't really matter, but it signifies true religion or God's way of life. In other passages, godliness means, and it's translated sometimes, God-likeness or a likeness to God. Godliness is often, if you look at a Greek dictionary, they'll say this word basically means God-likeness or a likeness to God. So again, Paul is saying, but godliness, being like God, a likeness to God, is what? Well, it doesn't finish there. It doesn't just say God being like God is great gain, which it is, but it says godliness with contentment is great gain. That's something to think about. Now, contentment. Contentment. What's he saying there? I jotted down, excuse me, explanation from this Bible dictionary. It's called the Bible Illustrator. And I'll just read what the man says here. It says, discontent always springs from pride and an overweening conceit of our own value and excellence. We are all by nature high-minded and esteem ourselves as more than we're worth. But, you know, God sees us a lot higher than we even see ourselves. You know, God's worth, he created us. He created mankind for a reason. God sees mankind way, way important. But humanly speaking, oftentimes we think how of our worth and how it's what we are need, what we feel like we need. It says, true religion, by humbling a man, tends to produce contentment, for it shows him or her and makes him or her feel that he really deserves nothing. Did any of us deserve the gift of life? Did we do something that God had to give us life? God created us because he loves us. God didn't give us life because, you deserve it. No, we weren't even existing, and God gave us life. So everything that a man, if a man sees this, it says everything he has is more than he deserves. Since he who values himself as nothing will count everything he receives to be above his value, therefore they call on him for gratitude. Now, again, let's think about this. Godliness, being like God. But again, godliness with contentment, it says it's great gain. And I looked up the word contentment, the Greek word, autarkeia, I believe. It's autarkeia is the English transliteration of it. Contentment, the definition is a competency, a sufficiency, that portion of secular things which is necessary for the support of life. So, think about it. It refers to the state of mind, a calm, satisfied feeling of freedom from murmuring and complaining. So, where am I getting here? Godliness, being like God, and being content, being happy. Yeah, there's nobody in here. If somebody called me and said, I want to give you $1 million and no strings attached, I would not, you know, I wouldn't hang up on the phone. I'd say, let's talk about this. But humanly speaking, how many people in this world are just content, are just happy overall? Content. You know, when I first started keeping the Sabbath, it was 1972. I was living in New Orleans. And I was living in an apartment by myself in New Orleans, a one-bedroom apartment. And I had never really, you know, I'd work, and I would work all week, the job I'd have. And then I remember the first few times on Friday night when I would started keeping the Sabbath, and I didn't work, and I didn't go out and, you know, play golf or go out and go to movies. I just stayed home and kept the Sabbath at first. I remember amazingly how the feeling I had, I just felt, I never realized how tired I was until I just stopped and just didn't, you know, I just had a nice evening, and then I wasn't running around trying to go places and buy things, and I went to church the next day, but I always remember on Friday night I would just feel so exhausted at first because I didn't realize how exhausted I probably was because I was just going. All these different directions. In fact, it was a wonderful feeling. Now, I'm not saying you have to just sit on your chair, but I was so relieved that I didn't have any work I had to do, that I didn't have any places I had to go. I just enjoyed the Sabbath and went to church and spent time with friends. Now let's look back at the verse we read, but let's read a little further here, because Paul wasn't finished just by verse 6. So 1 Timothy 6:6, godliness with contentment is great gain, but then he starts explaining it more, beginning in verse 7. For we brought nothing into the world. Not a one of us had anything when we came to the world. God gave us life, didn't he? We had nothing. We brought nothing into the world. And it's certain we can carry nothing out. The Pharaohs, remember how they had all the, they would put food and all the things in the tomb when they were buried because they thought they were going to be able to use it later? No. There's no matter how much money we've got, no matter how many things we've got, when we die, we go rest and wait for God to call us. Penny and I, when we were living in Chattanooga, we were buying a house because we're living in an apartment, and we were buying a house. We bought a house. We started looking around for a house in North Georgia because actually the prices were less in Georgia than Tennessee. And we were looking around, and we looked at several houses, and there was one house that we looked at, and we called it the boathouse. And the reason we called it the boathouse, they had a big boat in the garage, but they had. It was amazing the things they had. They had all these, they had the best computers. They had the biggest screen TV. They had, amazing workout facilities, like going to the gym or something. They had all these different things. And they had photos, and they looked like they were probably in their early 30s, maybe, or late 20s, early 30s. I thought, how does a person have that many things? How does a person have that many things when they're that young? And we both talked about, we wonder why they may be selling the house. Maybe they're so far in debt. Of course, we didn't know, but it says we brought nothing into the world. That certainly we can take nothing out. But those are and having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Well, we want more than just food and clothes. But he's saying, you know what? There are people that have very, very little that are a whole lot happier than people that have massive amounts of money. But he says, but those those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. What it's saying, if you're just grasping, grasping for things, it doesn't mean that God doesn't want you to be successful, but if you're just grasping, you don't care who you hurt. Are you really going to be happy? Is that what's going to really make you happy? For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. See, it's not that you don't, it's not to improve ourselves. It's not that we don't want to work hard and be successful. But some people that have so much are so very, very unhappy. It's amazing. We talked a lot about that family. We didn't buy that house. We bought another house. But that was one of the three houses we were looking at. They're all about the same price. I thought the house wasn't very big. It was just an average size house. But they had, it was so many things and gadgets and that I thought, where did they get all the money for this? There's a story, a true story I read about. It said, as a simple living Quaker man and woman were watched their new neighbor move into the neighborhood. And the new neighbor had all these furnishes and furnishings, expensive toys, gadgets, all the things successful people collect. And he said he just kept watching them bringing in thing after thing after thing. He thought, how much stuff do they have? Said the Quaker finally went over to his new neighbor and he said, "Neighbor, if you ever need anything, come see me and I'll tell you how to get along without it." Because he didn't have much, but he saw all these things and he thought, how happy is it making him? Again, those who desire to be rich, it's not that you don't work hard. It's not that you aren't, if you can be successful, great. But how many people just grasp for things and they don't want to take time to do important things? Like today, you know, how many people read today? How many people just read? A lot of people don't, they don't have time to read, they say. Some people feel they have to have more and more and more and more material things in order to be happy, to be successful. And yet, the more they have, it doesn't make them any happier if they don't have a basis for life. Now, there was an author named Henry David Thoreau who wrote back in the 1800s. I don't know much about him, but I got this quote. He mentioned, or it's not a quote, but it's something he mentioned. He said he reminded us that a man is wealthy in proportion to the number of things he can afford to do without. The most of persons, if you can be satisfied to not have the new car, not that it's wrong to have a new car, not that it's wrong to be successful, but it's so much grasping for things, so much grasping and thinking they need things. So I've read, remember I started back in verse 6, godless contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world, there's certainly nothing we can carry out. Having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. But these are those who desire to be rich in the wrong way, fall into temptation and a snare and all kind of many foolish things and harmful lust, which drown men and women, of course, in destruction and perdition. If you're only grasping for things, if I'm only grasping for things, is it really going to make me happy? For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness. You know, I remember when I started attending church back in New Orleans, I would go to church and I started in the summer of 72, and I didn't even know there was a Feast of Tabernacles. And when they came back from the Feast of Tabernacles, I said, well, they were talking about all the things they did. I said, how do you pay for that stuff? And they told me, well, you don't know what second tithe is? I thought, oh, wow, I can't do that. But I remember going home from church that week and thinking, I can't do this. And then you start thinking about it and you think, no, I know too much. I know I need to do. And now what would I do if I couldn't go to the Feast of Tabernacles if I had the opportunity? You know, it's amazing, isn't it, how you're perspective changes. But you know what? It doesn't end right there. Notice the next verse of what Paul tells Timothy. He says, but you, O man of God. He said, Timothy, you're a Christian. This is what you should do, Timothy. You, O man of God, flee these things. Flee what? All this grasping for the wind. And pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. You tell that to the average person out there, and he would laugh. He or she would say, what? It's like I've told you this before. I remember the lady that was standing around the water cooler at work one morning. And they were all talking about which would you rather have, $1 million or to live forever. And every one of them said, I'll take the $1 million. Who wants to live forever? And the woman said, well, I'd rather live forever. But yet they looked at her like she was from some other planet or something. Paul said, Timothy, you're a man of God, or woman of God, if you're a woman. Flee this grasping and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. How much of that do we see in the world we live today? Yet God said, that's what will make you happy. That's what will make you content. That's what will, you know, all any of the other things you get that God blesses you with, that's wonderful. But all the things in the world on itself is not going to make us happy by itself. Let's turn over to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 13. Verse 5, it says, let your conduct be without covetousness. You know, covetousness is one of the Ten Commandments. Let your conduct be without covetousness and be content with such things as you have. You know, some people have more than others. God has blessed certain people financially, but God's blessed other people with wisdom and health and various and sundry things. But he says, be content with what you have. For he himself said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. God said, I'm never going to leave you. I'm never going to forsake you. Be content. Don't think things are going to, in and of themselves, make you happy. And then he continues here and says, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? And yet, you know, you look around, you see what's going on in the world and the government, some of the things we're told, and yet we think, what's going to happen? We don't know. The one thing we feel that we know, in fact, we know that we know, is things aren't improving, are they, in this world? Things aren't getting better. I remember when the new baby was born this week in England. President Obama sent a message, and we're over at Ms. Braswell's in Kingsport, or she lives in Morristown, and it said, this baby is so blessed to grow up at this time in life when things are getting so much better. I thought, man, I thought I'd complain about that. This baby is so blessed to be born in a time where this world is improving so much. And yet people have this feeling, they know something's not right. They know something out there is frightening. They know something out there doesn't seem like it's all fitting together right. But yet, we don't necessarily, in a sense, know what to do physically. But God says, you'll never leave us. You'll never forsake us. It says, be content with what he's given us. We could be living in any country other than the United States, and yet, for some reason, God saw fit to let us be born to family here in a country that has so many things that others do not have. Sometimes going with that can be a great teacher. I know there was a World War I pilot named Eddie Rickenbacker, and I remember my father talking about him. He said he was a pilot. He got shot down, and for 21 days, he floated around in a life raft in the Pacific Ocean. Now, you know, it's always used to amaze me. The ocean has all this water, but it's salt water. You can't drink it. And this Eddie Rickenbacker said that he was hopelessly lost. He didn't know if anybody was ever going to rescue him. He was there for 21 days. He got hungry, and he couldn't. There's no water of that to drink. And he had a few little supplies that came down with the plane, but he was hoping someone would rescue him, and he was finally rescued. And he said when he survived, he was asked if he learned any lessons. And I'll quote what he said. He said, the biggest lesson that I learned from that experience was that if you have all the fresh water you want to drink and all the food you want to eat, you ought to never complain about anything. Because he saw the difference. In short, in this world, complaining has sort of become a way of life. Complain, complain. And again, I know I do it, so I know I'm not immune to this. But what we should think about what God tells us to say here, to do. Everyone in this room, if you think about it, everybody in this room can think of somebody they know that they just think complains excessively, I guess you could say. You know, it could be a relative, it could be somebody you work with. It could be, you know, everybody, you can think of somebody. I know somebody Penny and I were talking about, we hadn't talked to them in quite a while. They don't live around here. But I remember this person, every time they would call, they would complain, wouldn't they? Everybody's complaining, complaining, thinking, I can't solve your problems. I got enough of my own. I'm complaining. But you know how you just like, they were just, everything was wrong. And it was just like, well, I've told this, but I remember this lady in church in another church area years ago that used to complain and complain to me every week about nobody cared about her and nobody would help her out. Nobody would do this, that, or the other thing. And finally, you know, once the church, one of the church areas that I was in then, took up a collection to help her out and gave her, it was over $1,000. Over $1,000. And yet, she did give them a thank you card, but I never heard anything else. She's back complaining about nobody cared about her again. And then one time, a lady was having a baby. And the lady was having the baby, and they asked the ladies in church if they could make a meal for this lady that was having the baby. And this woman that was complaining all the time came up to me and she said, can you believe the nerve? They asked me to make a meal. Like, I've got time to make a meal. I have a job. I didn't really know what to say. I could have asked for $1,000 back, but I only gave about 10 of it myself, so I didn't really do too much. But I thought, man, these people, they showed her love. They collected all this money to help her out. So I guess we could say we all need to look at ourselves and say, am I a positive or a negative person most of the time? We all complain from time to time, and there's a lot of hard things going on. But like God said, how content are we with what He's given us and the blessings and just knowing God's way of life and His truth? How much do we thank God for that? I used to work with a girl years ago that was, we were pretty good friends. You know, we would talk about things from time to time, but this was years and years ago. And I remember one day, her name was Maria. And one day I said, and I'll never forget, I said, Maria, I wonder if I died, if anyone would come to my funeral. And I'll never forget what she said. She says, I think you'd be surprised. Well, that can mean either way, couldn't it? That can mean all these people are flooding in, or nobody showed up. I remember a person, I don't know what made me think of this. I remember a person died once. He wasn't in the church. His wife was in the church, and the man died, and I think his name was, I can't remember. I think it was Harry or something, but say Harry. And I remember I thought, well, I go over into visitation. And I went over to the funeral home, the visitation, and there was nobody there. But Harry was laying up there in the casket. And I walked up, and I'll never forget. I remember I walked up there and I said, well, Harry, it's just you and me. And then I, nice, you know, nice thoughts there, Harry. And signed the guest register and left. I thought, poor Harry didn't even have anybody show up. Now that wasn't the funeral. I'm sure he had people at the funeral, but, and I came at kind of an odd time, I guess, but it's just me and Harry. God said in Hebrews 13:5 that we read, He'll never leave us. He'll never forsake us. You know, this was not a long sermon. Maybe longer than you want it to be, but it wasn't a long sermon, but I'm almost finished. Let's look at a couple more verses. Let's look at Proverbs first, chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30. These are the words it says of Agur. You know, much of Solomon wrote a lot of Proverbs, but this was written by Agur, the son of Jecha, whoever that is. Verse 8 says, remove falsehood and lies from me. How many people in this world lie? And how many people just trample over others and don't even think a thing about it? And this Agur says, God, remove falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty. Nobody wants to be a have nothing. Give me neither poverty nor riches. He didn't want to be poor, but he didn't want to be too rich either. Why? He says, feed me with the food you prescribe for me, lest I be full and deny you. You know, like, remember it says some people have so much that it becomes a snare to them. Unless somebody fool and deny you and say, who is the Lord? I don't need God, is basically what it's saying. Or, lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of God. You know, too rich, you forget how much we need God. Too poor, if we, you know, break God's laws, and then we dishonor God's name. Philippians chapter 4. It's the last scripture, and then I have three little points I'll mention to think about. But Philippians chapter 4, verse 11, 12, and 13. Here's the Apostle Paul, who went through so much, but he was so appreciative, and he was always praising God, and every now and then we see some of the things he had to go through for the name of being a Christian. Verse 11, 12, and 13, Philippians 4. Not that I speak in regard to need, Paul said. I have learned in whatever state I'm in to be content. Paul said, I'm basically a happy person. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. And then he kind of sums it up in that last verse, verse 13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Paul said, all the things, the good things I've got, it's because of the blessings of God. So if you can't seem to get no satisfaction, what's the remedy? I got three things if you want to jot them down, or if you don't, that's fine. Number one, seek godliness that produces contentment, which is great gain. That's what we read about today. Seek godliness that produces repentance or contentment, which is great gain. I'm just going to turn back to 1 Timothy 6 again. I read it earlier. Notice what he said on this point. He says, but O man of God, verse 11 of 1 Timothy 6, flee these things, what? The snares, and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. That'd be a full-time job if we just thought about these things and worked toward these things. Being developed into a genuine copy of Jesus Christ is the greatest privilege a human being can ever have. See, godliness that produces contentment is great gain. Being developed into a genuine copy of Jesus Christ is the greatest privilege, to be able to be a Christian. Despite all our faults and flaws, what a privilege that God would call us to His truth. Second point, which I just read in Philippians, is learn to abound in whatever physical condition you may find yourself. Learn to abound in whatever physical condition you may find yourself. Like I mentioned, Ed Caldwell, he doesn't have a nose. He's losing part of his face. And you know what? He told me that he thinks that was for his good. Thank God's helping him. And yet God is helping him, but no one would want to go through something like that. There's always someone a whole lot worse off than any of us. No matter how little you've got, no matter how many trials you've got, there's always someone that's got it worse. Number three, if it should happen, and it appears that our country's heading that way, if it should happen that the things we have are greatly diminished in our material circumstances, you know, our economy, our jobs, whatever the case may be, if it should come about that you and I are greatly diminished in our material circumstances, we need to never forget that we're God's people and that He's performing a great work in us. Remember, He said, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you, but strive toward God's way of life, and faith and hope and love and patience and gentleness and all those things. Never forget we're God's people and that He's performing a great work in our lives. He wants us to be in His kingdom, His family someday. In short, be content, for godliness that produces contentment is great gain.